Thank you all for coming. Carrie Janelle is an author, discographer, and music historian, in addition to being a record collector with a range of musical tastes too extravagant for his budget. I've been looking forward to reading this all week, actually. He graduated insignificantly from a few ordinary California universities, but his main research studies into 78s began at the Jazzman Record Shop in Los Angeles, California, which is the topic of his paper today. Carrie's a four-time winner of the ARSC Award for Excellence and is currently working on a book version of his talk, expanding his research concerning this extremely important and influential record store. Please join me in welcoming Carrie Janelle.
The Jazzman Record Shop was one of the first and one of the last record stores to target collectors of vintage jazz recordings. Through its various portals passed the greats of jazz's first generation of stars, including Jelly Roll Morton, Kid Ory, and Louis Armstrong. Musicians as well as collectors came there to research, to meet one another, to strike deals, or simply to hang out. It was also responsible for jump-starting the traditional jazz revival of the 1940s through its series of recordings on the Jazzman record label from 1941 to 1954. It all started in 1939 when a young Los Angeles record collector named David Stewart discovered that he was having trouble finding Jazz 78s to broadcast on his daily radio program. Born in 1910 in Glendale, California, Stewart was an art student who had a love for traditional New Orleans jazz. The swing era was on, and the traditional jazz of the 1920s had all but disappeared. King Oliver was dead. His last job was as a janitor in a Savannah, Georgia pool room. Jelly Roll Morton was struggling to jumpstart his career in Los Angeles, talking to and playing for anyone who would listen. Kid Ory hadn't picked up his trombone in years and was working in a Los Angeles post office. Bunk Johnson was driving a truck in the rice fields of New Iberia, Louisiana. Louis Armstrong had adapted to the swing orchestra sound that had swept the nation, all but abandoning the spontaneous music he helped create. Realizing that there was no place for collectors to buy and trade used 78s, Dave Stewart opened a record shop on the Sunset Strip in Hollywood, calling himself the Jazz Man. The shop stocked only jazz, not the swing of Tommy Dorsey and Glenn Miller, but the real thing, used 78s from the golden era of traditional jazz and race music. The exact location of the original Jazz Man is not known, but it was possibly on DeLongpre Avenue between Sunset Boulevard and Fountain. A local weekly collector's newsletter called Jazz Information noted in its issue dated December 15, 1939, that the Jazz Man had recently opened and was the first shop in the vicinity to sell and trade rare records. Within a few months, Stewart moved to a larger shop at 1221 Vine Street between Sunset and Santa Monica Boulevard next to a large movie house. As word got out about the Jazz Man, actors and producers, such as Orson Welles, a Clarence Williams fan, would seek out the shop and its knowledgeable owner. One of the most distinguished visitors was Igor Stravinsky, the esteemed classical composer. Stewart recalled later that Stravinsky would come in and listen to jazz, especially 78s by King Oliver, but would never buy anything. In early 1941, a down-on-his-luck Jelly Roll Morton found the shop on Vine Street and became friendly with Stewart and Stewart's friend Charles Campbell. The two decided to interview Morton, who was then ill and living in the Central Avenue district. They drove around in Morton's old Cadillac, with Stewart in front asking the questions and Campbell in the back, taking it all down in shorthand. We were hoping to have Mr. Campbell with us tonight, today, but he had a last-minute commitment and couldn't make it. So what I'm going to do in his stead is read some of the liner notes to a timeless reissue of Jelly Roll Morton piano works from this period, which is very enlightening, and he would have probably told this very same story if he was here. By the early 1930s, I had started collecting jazz records. After some college years, I got a job in Los Angeles, and in 1939 met David Stewart and began hanging out in his Hollywood record store on my days off. The Jazzman Record Shop was the only record store anywhere at that time. I believe that carried only jazz. He wouldn't even stock records by the hot swing bands. Goodman, Shaw, and such. Early on, I had started collecting Bix, and then early Armstrong, Oliver, Clarence Williams, and such groups, and to some extent, Morton records. They weren't easy to find, but I had most of the Red Hot Peppers, many of which were reissued on Bluebird. In early 1941, David heard that Jelly Roll was in Los Angeles, and we made an effort to find where he was staying. A few weeks later, we got his address in the Central Avenue District of Los Angeles at the house of Dink Johnson, also a piano player, who was, I believe, Jelly's brother-in-law. After all those years of hearing about him and searching out his music, finding him that Saturday morning at Dink's house was a great treat. He could not have been more friendly to two jazz fans, and he started talking about early New Orleans musicians and early piano players. After that first meeting, we asked him if we could take notes, and he had no objection. I was very good at shorthand, so the next meetings with Jelly would be in restaurants where we would take him to lunch. I would try to take down everything he said about the old days, so didn't have much time to eat, since he would take about 10 minutes to answer any question about musicians we had heard about. It was very fascinating. We were not aware that much of this material had been recorded by Alan Lomax at the Library of Congress, most of it in 1938. We were able to phone him at Dink's and make appointments for our lunch meetings. Once in a while, he would say that he wasn't feeling well enough to meet us. Then a week or so later, he would be better, and we'd pick him up at Dink's house. I never heard him play on a job, since he wasn't working while in Los Angeles in those days. He did show us on Dink's piano how so-and-so used to sound, players like Louis Chauvin and Tony Jackson, who hadn't recorded. The only player he really seemed to respect was Jackson. I asked him about Earl Hines, a favorite of mine in those days, and he said, "I tried to catch up with Hines in Chicago and play with him, but he always ducked out." Some things come to mind. Jelly showed us a financial statement from Victor Records indicating royalties due him for the past year for $25 for King Porter's Stomp, which was a fairly big seller for Benny Goodman. It seemed like an outrageously small sum to me and an injustice to this legendary composer-musician, but how could a couple of young jazz aficionados take on the mighty Victor Company? Then I asked him about some of his song titles. Fussy Mabel? Oh, I used to know a gal called Mabel, and she was very fussy around the time that record was made. He always gave logical and amusing answers to our naive questions. I had all of the recently released Mortons on the general label, the Jelly Roll Morton 7, and he said he liked the results quite a lot, except he sort of apologized for Sweet Substitute as being a pop tune. Another thing he told us is that he wrote Someday Sweetheart, but sold the rights to the Spikes Brothers. He also said he preferred cornetist George Mitchell to Armstrong. We were up to about 1912 in the interviews when we heard that Jelly was very ill and confined to a small private hospital in the Central Avenue District. I found it and visited him there. It was a small, dirty hole of a place, and he was miserable being there. He promised he'd let us know when he got out, but his condition got worse, and he was taken to the Los Angeles County Hospital. He died there July 10, 1941. I was working as a clerk in a stuffy oil company office, and they wouldn't give me time off to attend a funeral unless it was a relative. My girlfriend and I sent some flowers, and we received a card with thanks for our expression of sympathy, signed Mrs. Anita Morton. I still have it. I turned over all of my transcribed shorthand notes to David Stewart for him to do something about an article for one of the jazz publications. But before anything could be done, the war started for us. David became a navigator in the Air Transport Command, and I joined the Coast Guard for 4 years. Everything pertaining to the Jelly Roll Morton interviews was lost. But my memory of him as a proud, congenial, articulate person is vivid after all of these years. Charles Campbell, San Francisco, California. When Morton died that July, David Stewart was the only white person to attend the funeral services. It was about this time that Stewart moved the Jazz Man again, a few blocks south to 6331 Santa Monica Boulevard. In San Francisco, a musical revolution was brewing. A night spot called the Dawn Club, located on Annie Street, just south of Market, was becoming the hottest joint in town, especially when Lou Waters was playing there. Waters was a trumpet player who idolized the sound of traditional New Orleans jazz, especially the classic two-cornet lineup of King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band. In 1940, Waters formed the Yerba Buena Jazz Band, which was patterned after the Oliver Band. Soon, Waters had the most popular act in town. Down in Hollywood, Dave Stewart listened to radio broadcasts of the Waters Band from the Dawn Club and talked Charles Campbell into driving up to hear the band in person. After doing so, Stewart and Waters struck a deal to hold a recording session, which would take place in December 1941. 12 days after Pearl Harbor, Stewart returned to the Bay Area with another Waters fan named Lester Koenig, who was working as a writer at Paramount Pictures. Koenig bankrolled the recording session, and on December 19th, the Yerba Buena Jazz Band recorded 8 titles. In January, the records were released on Dave Stewart's brand new Jazzman label in a 4-pocket, 78 RPM album featuring a photograph of the Waters Band. Jazzman wasn't the first label started by a record store. There's the first session right there. The Commodore, Gramophone, and Liberty Music Shops in New York all came about earlier. But these stores dealt mostly with new material, while the Jazzman catered specifically to collectors of older jazz and sold used records. The Waters album proved to be a sensation, sparking a nationwide revival of San Francisco's version of New Orleans jazz, which served as an alternative to the relatively antiseptic and highly structured sounds coming from the big bands. The San Francisco jazz sound could be characterized as a New Orleans-style ensemble sound, with a brass bass or tuba emphasizing the heavy beat on the first and third beats of a measure, and banjos emphasizing the 2 and 4 beat, so every beat was emphasized. The band was also featuring 2 cornets or trumpets and a tailgate trombone. In March 1942, the group recorded 14 additional sides, which were issued as individual singles on the Jazzman label, priced at $1.05, tax included, a steep price at a time when Bluebird and Decca records were selling for 35 cents. Shortly after the second session, Lou Waters and some of his sidemen were drafted, and the band went on hiatus until after the war. But the revival Waters started was in full gear, and Dave Stewart began searching for some of the music's founding fathers. In early 1942, a strikingly attractive 22-year-old jazz fan from Portland, Oregon, named Merrilee Morden, walked into the Jazzman, anxious to meet the man who had put Lou Waters on record. Morden and Stewart hit it off, and soon they got married, sharing the duties of running the shop. About that time, Stewart decided to seek out legendary trumpet player Bunk Johnson, who was an early mentor of Louis Armstrong, and who had, when he was young, reportedly played with Buddy Bolden. Johnson had been corresponding with traditional jazz collector Bill Russell and author Frederick Ramsey Jr., author of the seminal book on New Orleans jazz called Jazzmen. Bunk hadn't played since 1932, when his cornet was destroyed in a dance hall fight. Since then, his teeth had been giving him much discomfort, and he told Ramsey and Russell that if they bought him a cornet and a new set of teeth, he'd make records again. Well, the two approached Eugene Williams, publisher of Jazz Information, to see if he would record Bunk. Williams thought Dave Stewart would be better equipped to record Johnson since Jazzman had better distribution. The cornet and the choppers were delivered to Bunk, and he agreed to record. On June 1, 1942, Stewart, jazz fan Bill Colburn, and San Francisco disc jockey Hal McIntyre set out by car for Louisiana. Johnson had assembled a stellar band of veteran jazzmen, including George Lewis on clarinet and Jim Robinson on trombone. On June 11th, Stewart recorded Bunk Johnson's original Superior Band at Grunewald's Music Store in New Orleans. 9 sides were eventually issued. I'm not sure if that's a celebrant or a Klansman on the left. The next day, Johnson reminisced about his career in jazz for the microphone. These interviews were also released on 2 special edition Jazzman 78s, which sold for $4 for the set of 2. Johnson revealed much fascinating information in this and other interviews. However, historians would later prove that there was a reason for Bunk Johnson's nickname, or an alternate reason, because that's what most of his stories turned out to be, a lot of bunk. 50 copies of each disc were pressed, with Johnson autographing many of the copies. In this excerpt, Bunk talks about playing with the legendary Buddy Bolden in 1895, which would have been impossible since it was later discovered that Bunk was born 10 years later than he claimed, making him only 6 years old when he supposedly played with Bolden. Still a great storyteller.
Tell us, where did you learn to play cornet?
Where did I learn to play cornet? I learned to play cornet when I was 10 years old in English. I learned to play cornet under Professor Kutcher Wallace in Scotland. He was our teacher at New Orleans University, and also our organist in chapel. And he's the man that taught me cornet and writing music. And I take lessons with him from the age of 6 years old until I finished New Orleans University. I come out of New Orleans University in 1894, and I was fit for orchestra. I went to that Orleans band, my first band. Played with them just a short while, and I had the opportunity of guaranteeing Bolden's band at Lincoln Park. And I got crazy to play with Bolden, and Bolden played my style of music that I like. I like to read, but I rather play that Haydn music better. More jazz to it. I like to read, I could read good reader. And Bolden played mighty much by hand and made up his own tunes. But everything that he played, I could whistle, I could play. And I jumped Olympic band and went to Bolden. That was in 1895. I was privileged to play blues. Bolden were playing blues of all kinds. So when I got to Bolden, we had to make more blues. Blue that we made a record of, Two Collard on the Floor. That was played in 1894 by King Bolden. And quadrilles, I played with quadrilles. It's quadrilles, questioning bars of what the band used today, Tiger Ray. That's King Bolden's questioning bars. We would play to Dickie Farden's record of quadrilles. And the lady there was taken and turned into Tiger Ray by musicians that could read, and Bolden who music, probably Bolden would have made Tiger Ray. So we played Gimme No Tiger Ray before we had any Dixieland Jazz Band. Dixieland Jazz Band was the one that taken Tiger Ray, the 28 bars, and turned it into the dance number, what the dance today would call Tiger Ray. and read it here. Bowling lost his mind. Frank Dewson took the bowling band and turned it into the Eagle Band.
Bunk Johnson's recordings were well received, resulting in the revival of his career, which lasted until his death in 1949 at the age of 60. In late 1942, Dave Stewart took a three-month course in navigation and got a job in the Air Transport Command. According to Charles Campbell, it was a good job, paying some $900 a month. The Jazzman record shop was left for his wife, Marilee, to run until he returned from World War II. Marilee Stewart proved to be as much of an attraction to record collectors as the contents of the shop. According to trombonist Jim Lee, a young frequenter of the shop, everyone who came in was infatuated with her. Lee wrote in his biography the following about the jazz man in those days. "What I do remember is the feel of the jazz man, the bins of 10-inch 78s in their stiff tan sleeves, the enlarged wall photos of players for whose music I still have great affection, and above all, the dark, beautiful, unsmiling, formidably knowledgeable young woman who ran the place. There in the smoky afternoon light, with the green shade half drawn on the glass front door and the collector's items sleeping in their sleeves, Marilee might play a record without comment, or she might read, or simply smoke. Questioned, she would answer civilly, with an air of noblesse oblige. If she was otherwise silent, it was not for lack of knowledge or belief, but because evangelism would have been beneath her." Sometime in late 1942, a visitor arrived from Washington, D.C. The man was short in stature, but impeccably dressed. 24-year-old Nesui Erdogan, the wealthy son of a Turkish diplomat, had spent the last 4 years in Washington amassing his own collection of Jazz 78s. During that time, he had also met Jelly Roll Morton, who had been making his landmark series of interviews at the Library of Congress. Drawn to the jazz man's ice princess proprietor, Erdogan defrosted her by presenting her with four unissued piano solos made by Morton in 1938 after the LOC interviews. It was love at first spin. Not only did Marilee issue the four sides on the Jazzman label, but in 1943, she divorced her absent husband and married the dapper young Turk. In 1942, in December, Downbeat magazine excitedly announced the release of the four Morton sides, reporting that they were the biggest achievement since the release of the first records by Bunk Johnson. Dateline, Los Angeles. "The Jazzman Record Company issues a new set of records this month, and Mr. Jimmy Petrillo need have no worry as to whether they were recorded after his well-known August 31st deadline. They were recorded well before the deadline, but just how long before is something the intellectuals of jazz can argue about, for these platters consist of four previously unissued solo recordings by the late Jelly Roll Morton, who died here in Los Angeles over a year ago. Titles are Honky Tonk Music, Wine and Boy Blues, a different version than that on General, Finger Buster, and Creepy Feeling. Like all of Jelly Roll Morton's piano solos, these records are either unspeakably corny or glorious examples of the purest kind of jazz, depending on the musical viewpoint of the listener. One thing certain is that they are not only authentic Mortons, but some of the finest examples of his work. For Jazzman Records Company, now operated by Mrs. Marilee Stewart, while her husband Dave Stewart navigates in the ferry command, it is the biggest achievement since the release of the first records by Bunk Johnson, famous old-time jazz figure who taught Louis Armstrong how to play." Thank you. Finger Buster. The jazz man struggled through the war years until early 1944, when actor-producer Orson Welles called Marilee Morden and asked her if she could put together an authentic New Orleans-style jazz band for a radio program he was doing on CBS. Within minutes, she had called a friend, Kid Ory, who agreed to do the show. After a few more well-placed phone calls, Marilee had formed a group that would be called the All-Star New Orleans Band. Their on-air performance of High Society was an instant hit, and Welles hired the group for 13 weeks. In August, Nesui Erdogan announced that the jazz man was establishing a new label called Crescent in honor of New Orleans, the Crescent City, to be created specifically for recordings by the All-Stars, which were now called Kid Ory's Creole Jazz Band. Four sessions were held between August 1944 and November 1945, with eight discs eventually being issued. The Ory sides became nationwide news, with a story on the veteran jazz man appearing in Time magazine. This is the earliest known picture that I have of the interior of the jazz man shop at any of their locales, with Nesui and Marilee flanking Kid Ory. Crescent Records had the name of the pressing plant, Bishop Pressing, embossed in raised letters on the labels, which is kind of unusual. I think you saw that. If we go back to this one, you can see it. Yeah. Over on the left side, you'll see Bishop, and the right side, it says Pressing. Sometime in 1945, Erdogan and Morden moved the jazz man across the street and down the block to 6420 Santa Monica Boulevard. Curiously, Crescent number 1 showed the old Vine Street address on one side of the record and the new Santa Monica address on the other. In the next few years, they also reissued all of the old Lou Waters and Bunk Johnson masters on a newly designed green label version of Jazzman Records. Eventually, all 16 Ory sides were also reissued on Jazzman using parallel catalog numbers. Crescent number 1 became Jazzman 21. Crescent 2 was Jazzman 22, and so forth. Nesui Erdogan turned out to be a tireless worker and unbridled enthusiast for the rejuvenated traditional jazz scene. In addition to running the Jazzman record shop, he recorded other exponents of the traditional jazz movement, including two West Coast groups, Pete Daly's Rhythm Kings and Turk Murphy's Bay City Stompers, during one week in December 1947. The success of the new movement led to Lester Koenig, Dave Stewart's benefactor at the original Lou Waters session, to start his own traditional jazz label called Good Time Jazz in 1949. The label's featured act was a group of animators who worked for Walt Disney, who teamed up to form the Firehouse 5 Plus 2. Looking for more artists to release on his label, Koenig arranged to purchase all existing sides made for Jazzman, a fact that was announced in a newsletter sent out to Jazzman customers on January 22, 1952. Good Time Jazz would release the early Jazzman titles on a series of 10-inch LPs, 78 singles, and 45 RPM EPs. Despite selling his catalog, Nesue Erdogan kept Jazzman Records going, cutting sessions at Capitol Records Studios with locally based artists such as Rosie McHarg, George Lewis, Johnny Whitwer, and Pete Daly. Aware of the new technology of recording tape, which enabled longer playing records, Erdogan began issuing 10-inch LPs and even an extended play 45. In the spring of 1954, Erdogan published a small record catalog, announcing ambitious plans to record, quote, as many traditional jazz concerts and live performances as possible.
Blues were born in New Orleans. They're in the heart of each one that you meet. Yes, the blues were born in New Orleans. They're in the heart of each one that you meet. Why, they make you laugh and sing, and you'll cry all the way down Burgundy Street.
Laid plans. All this was for naught because late in 1954, Nesue Erdogan and Merrilee divorced, resulting in the dividing of their assets. Merrilee left the business entirely, while Erdogan went to work for his younger brother Ahmet's R&B label Atlantic, being put in charge of its new jazz division. As the result of the divorce, the Jazzman label abruptly ceased to exist, the last release being a 10-inch LP of piano solos by ragtime musician Marvin Ash. In addition, the Jazzman record shop was sold to a businessman named Albert Van Cort Jr., who moved it to a dilapidated neighborhood near downtown Los Angeles at 2689 West Pico Boulevard, where it slowly began to deteriorate. Over the next 5 years, Van Cort hired a series of collectors to manage the shop, him having no interest in records whatsoever. The glory days of the Jazzman were over, but the shop would survive another 30 years. Van Cort's rotating staff of managers kept the shop open on weekday evenings and all day on Saturday, but the hours were sporadic, and it wasn't unusual for a collector to arrive at the shop during posted business hours only to find it closed. In May 1959, Don Brown, a jazz collector from Dixon, Illinois, took over as shop manager. Born in 1923, Brown had come to Hollywood in 1950 with his wife Darlene to become a screenwriter. In addition to having odd jobs in the entertainment industry, Brown had been, since 1956, publishing The Record Finder, a monthly publication directed to record collectors that included jazz news, reviews, and a short list of 78s he would put up for auction. He was a voracious collector of jazz 78s himself, specializing in hot jazz, dance bands, and recordings by Duke Ellington. But Brown's interests didn't stop with jazz. He also enjoyed blues, country, R&B. A closet fan of romantic classical music, Brown would go home after locking up the shop at night and listen to Chopin. About his secret fondness for classical music, Brown would say, "Well, when you run a candy store, you don't go home at night and eat candy." After a few months of running the shop, Brown offered to buy it from Van Cort. Van Cort, who was not a collector and was, at this juncture, desperate to unload his quickly fading white elephant, jumped at the opportunity. The bill of sale showed that Brown acquired ownership of the rundown shop and its contents, some 30,000 78s, for the munificent total of $500. For those of you without a calculator, that comes out to around 1.6 cents per record. Brown took over in the first week of January 1960, and within a short time, the aura of the shop changed. Unbeknownst to Brown, Perry Pugh, one of the managers that Van Cort had hired, had absconded with most of the collector's items still in the shop. So Don had to do something about that. He expanded the shop's hours and also beefed up the stagnating stock. Brown had a knack for finding records just about anywhere, tirelessly scouring junk shops and Salvation Army and Goodwill stores, acquiring thousands of discs from radio stations, and purchasing collections from old jazz musicians' widows. He also expanded the scope of his stock, adding country music, blues, big band, and popular artists as well. Brown was fond of saying, "If it's got a hole in it, I can sell it." From the beginning, his philosophy of something for everyone worked, and the jazz man drew collectors like moths to a flame. In time, the picked over stock of about 30,000 78s grew to as much as 60,000. Brown plugged the shop in his mail order catalogs, the Record Finder newsletter, and on his radio program Cobweb Corner on FM radio station KRHM. I love this, the show that set radio back 35 years. Thank goodness. He also began stocking jazz LPs, setting up connections with various independent labels that reissued vintage jazz. As any record collector knows, where good records reside, characters follow. And over the nearly quarter century that he ran the shop, the cigar-chomping Brown became the central figure in a situation comedy, with a cast of idiosyncratic characters coming to the shop on a regular basis. By 1962, a core group of about a dozen collectors was meeting at the shop every Saturday. Don Brown would eventually dub them the Saturday crowd. Some members of the Saturday crowd were holdovers from the 50s, but many, such as college school teacher John Fraser and hillbilly historian Eugene Earle, were new arrivals. Each member had his own specialized interests. Don Gray was just a pushover for a brass bass. Nat Ross, who always arrived at the shop in one vintage car after another, each successive one in worse shape than the previous one, liked vocal groups, the Mills Brothers, Boswell Sisters, and was a big fan of early motion pictures. Doug Lawler had very narrow tastes. He liked piano music between 1927 and 1932. Alan Roberts was a swing fan. Donald Lee Nelson liked string bands and Cajun music. With everybody there, if you walked into that shop, you'd hear just about anything on any given Saturday. A highlight of the jazz man's years on West Pico Boulevard occurred in August 1965, when shop regular Joe Levi walked in one day escorting the legendary Reb Spikes, who in 1919, with his brother Johnny, had started the Spikes Brothers Music House, the only other Los Angeles record store to stock old jazz and blues 78s. Spikes would record Kid Ory in 1921, the first black jazz artist to record, which were issued on the memorable Sunshine label, which was pasted over the Nordskog record it was recorded for. Spikes spent a memorable day reminiscing with the crowd at the Jazz Man and was treated like a hero returning from battle. A few weeks before the Spikes visit, the Watts riots began. A bad neighborhood to begin with, West Pico Boulevard now got even worse, and within a few years, Brown saw his clientele drop precipitously. Early in 1968, he decided to relocate again to a storefront 10 miles west on Pico, in the cleaner, then safer beach community of Santa Monica. 3 days and one broken nose later, caused by tripping while carrying a box of records, Brown, working virtually by himself, moved the tens of thousands of 78s down Pico Boulevard toward the ocean. It was there, at 3323 Pico Boulevard, that the shop stayed for the next 15 years, the longest stay of its existence. With him went the Saturday crowd, not minding in the least the extra 10 miles they had to travel to get to their Saturday haven. Initially, they complained that the new shop just didn't have the same ambience as the old shop, the atmospheric blend of dust, dirt, silverfish, and falling plaster. But within a few months, they settled in, adopting the back room as their lair. Don gladly accommodated them, even buying a refrigerator for them to keep their beer in. There was rarely anything else ever stored in it. Over the next 20 years, Don Brown permitted these miscreants to hang out all day, every Saturday, even though their constant presence, ribald language, and harmless insults probably scared off many of his customers. Eventually, they would all become like second family to each other. The shop wasn't without its altercations, even though they were few and far between. The most legendary of these occurred sometime in the early 70s, when Bill Givens, a noted reissuer of old blues 78s, got into it with Bob Height of the 60s group Canned Heat. Height was known as the Bear because, well, he looked like a bear, 300 pounds, with a full beard, growling demeanor, a buckskin jacket, and floppy hat. Height was one of the world's consummate connoisseurs of old country blues 78s and had a fabulous collection. On this particular day, Givens had a few too many glasses of beer and made fun of Height's appearance. Before anyone realized it, they were on the floor, rolling all over one another, jostling the record racks, and scattering debris and silverfish everywhere. Celebrities continued to come into the shop, including one vaunted visit by Louis Armstrong himself, who autographed a publicity photo that hung on the jazz man's wall for years afterward. The most faithful celebrity fan of the shop was singer Mel Torme, who came in to browse during the week when shop traffic was light. The great jazz trumpeter player of the 20s and 30s, Jabbo Smith, came by in 1980 and was warmly received, as were pianist Mary Lou Williams, trumpeter Rex Stewart, and vocalist Scrappy Lambert, who signed over 80 records that collectors brought in that day. In May 1983, the proprietor of the Greek restaurant next door, wanting to expand, told the landlord that he would pay more money for rent than the jazzman would. So the landlord raised Don Brown's rent to a level where he just couldn't afford to run the shop anymore. Refusing to pay the increased rent, he was given 60 days to pack up his junk and leave. Rather than move again, at age 60, he'd had enough of hauling 78s from place to place and decided to hang it up. On July 10th, 1983, Don Brown closed the Jazzman for the last time.
The Jazzman in Santa Monica is a record store, a local institution, a hangout, and more. But it's time to turn out the lights. The Jazzman will soon be playing its last note. Hank Plant reports.
To an outsider, it's just a used record shop with a lot of old 78s. But to a jazz collector, the Jazzman shop in Santa Monica is a gold mine, the most extensive old jazz collection around. It's 40,000 jazz records, many of them rare. And it's the kind of a dusty old bin where a true collector knows he'll meet others who speak his language. And so the Jazzman has flourished since 1938 at different LA locations, here on Pico Boulevard for 15 years. But now it's all over. The shop is closing down in 3 weeks. The restaurant next door is expanding. And so the regulars, like the Saturday crowd that meets here to share music, will be no more.
Now, how long have you been coming in?
About 23 years. This is kind of a sad, sad affair.
Unfortunately, you're accurate on that.
What does this shop mean to you?
Oh, it means a lot in terms of recreation, fun, things like that, camaraderie with the others.
It was a great place to learn, you know.
Yeah.
more than any university could ever teach you. And what little I know, I learned here. I'll miss the place.
Yeah. I really hate to see this era come to an end. See a lot of people, celebrities from Hollywood come in here.
What are you going to do with your Saturdays now?
That does present a problem. Probably play records at home, or maybe we could even talk about forming another shop if possible.
The shop has been run for 23 years by Don Brown, whose Cobweb Corner jazz show will continue on KCRW-FM Sunday nights.
I have the feeling I'm watching the end of an era here, not just your shop, but what it represents.
I think so, because there's so many young kids that are coming up. There's so many people that call on the phone, and they have questions. And whether it's like a lady today wanted to know the proper spelling of Earl Klug's name. And they've got no place to turn. You call a commercial chain store, and they'll say, hmm?
Most of the 78s here are $3 to $5, but they're half off now because of the shops closing down. And so the jazz man goes the way of Ellington and Armstrong, Monk and Jelly Roll. They all belong to the ashes, but their music belongs to us. Nothing has ever equaled jazz as a truly American art form, and the Saturday crowd here at the Jazz Man knows that a significant part of all of this is going to die July 10th. In Santa Monica, this is Hank Plant, Channel 9 News.
Not knowing what to do with the 50,078 still in the shop, many of which had been there since the old Nesui Erdogan days, Brown sold everything, lock, stock, and silverfish, to Jonathan Pearl, a younger regular who hated to see the shop die. The price they settled on was $6,000, most likely much more than the records were worth. I, for a souvenir, took home two of the shelves, the shelving units, that held the 78s, and found it was a fossil of jazz information, including Mead Lux Lewis's phone number scrawled on the side with a pen. Jonathan Pearl rented a store in an outdoor mall in Burbank, a long ways off from Santa Monica. And 2 months after the Pico shop closed, the Jazz Man was open for business once again. Although knowledgeable about records, Pearl was not a businessman and didn't really have a good grasp of what Don Brown had done to maintain the shop and his clientele over a quarter century. By February 1984, days would go by before a single customer walked into the shop, and Pearl was forced to close it for good, selling the remaining records to a dealer in Kansas City. Although everyone was sad to see the Jazz Man breathe its last, it was probably time for it to go. Record collections had dried up, and it was getting more and more difficult to find 78s of value. The usual haunts had been picked over so many times that no good records remained. The new generation of music listeners in the 1980s was not interested in 78s, and compact discs, newly on the market, were beginning to dominate the scene. The Saturday crowd, now orphaned from their weekly daycare center, spent some years having monthly meetings at one of the members' houses, including mine, as seen here outside of my townhouse. Second from the left is Harvey Newland, who was one of the managers during the Van Cort era, and the next one over from him is Dr. Demento, who was a regular also. I hosted these get-togethers for about 5 years, but one by one, they either moved out of the area, passed away, or just lost touch with one another. As for the Jazz Man's owners, David Stewart opened a successful modern art gallery on La Cienega Boulevard in Los Angeles, which he ran until his death in 1984 at the age of 73. His obituary, seen here, failed to mention anything about his role in founding the Jazz Man and helping start the traditional jazz revival of the 1940s. After her divorce, Marilee Morden married Art Levin, another collector. She passed away in 1988 at the age of 68. Nesui Erdogan became a legend with Atlantic Records, responsible for important signings like John Coltrane, the Modern Jazz Quartet, and Herbie Mann to the label. The Erdogan Jazz Hall of Fame is named for him, a multimedia installation at Lincoln Center in New York, at which visitors can celebrate the lives of the musicians idolized by Erdogan during his many years with Atlantic. Nesui Erdogan died in 1989 at the age of 71. Don Brown joined the members of his Saturday crowd at their regular monthly get-togethers for a year after the Burbank shop closed, but died unexpectedly of a massive heart attack on May 30th, 1985. He was just 62. At his funeral, a traditional New Orleans jazz band played Just a Closer Walk with Thee in his honor. Here is an excerpt from Don Brown's last Cobweb Corner radio program on KCRW, broadcast May 29th, 1985, the day before his death.
Well, it's 2:36 in Santa Monica, KCRW, and the Cobweb Corner, and that means it's time to turn on the dancing shoes. Yes, it's the Cobweb Corner and the Spiders Tea Dance. Today on the bandstand from 1939, Henry Bussey, his trumpet, and his mute with his shuffle rhythm, the three strikes on the vocal. Sounds like a baseball game, doesn't it? With Henry Bussey and Oh, by Jingo.
In October 1975, while I was a 19-year-old student in the undergraduate radio TV film school at Cal State Northridge, my film class got an assignment to make a silent movie short. The project involved writing a script, setting up shots, and editing the film in teams of two. The movie was to be shot on 8mm film, but the budget was limited to $50. So after buying film and a couple of floodlights, I made my way over to the Jazzman and got Don Brown's permission to use the shop for the setting of my movie. I wanted to try and present a humorous look at what Don had to go through day in and day out. In addition, Don starred as the long-suffering owner of a rundown record shop. He proved to be not only a good sport, but a fabulous actor, as he joined two other friends of mine in an 8-minute comedy short about record collecting. Just a warning before you see this. It's pretty obvious that this is a low-budget film. You will see changes in lighting. In fact, if you're sharp enough, you'll be able to see the light in the shot. Poor editing, and some written sight gags that are a little hard to read that I could probably explain afterwards. One of my friends underacted, and the other overacted, but Don was great. You might also notice this 1929 poster of Bessie Smith's one and only film, St. Louis Blues, which we saw an excerpt from a couple of days ago, on the wall next to the turntable. Don Brown at one time refused to sell the poster to Rolling Stone Bill Wyman, even after Wyman offered him everything in his overstuffed wallet. So here we go for our world debut, not as history-making as yesterday's world debut. Nonetheless, here it is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Turned out, the closing of the Jazz Man in 1984 was a harbinger of things to come. Since that time, another quarter century has passed, and one by one, other collector's shops, as well as retail stores, giant conglomerate chains, as well as the traditional mom-and-pop shop, have bitten the dust. Everyone in this room has spent precious hours in these stores. For many, they have proven more educational than any book, any university, and even the internet. The neighborhood record store was the place where we listened and learned, met other collectors, and discovered the wondrous sounds of our musical past. With each store's closing, a piece of us dies with it. Maybe this is why ARSC has gotten progressively stronger over the past quarter century. As collectors, we need each other as much as we need those black, scratchy dust catchers, or in the case of this record, blue dust catcher. To paraphrase former New York Yankees pitcher Jim Boughton in Ball 4, we spend our lives holding on to our 78s, 45s, and 33s. But in the end, it turns out to be the other way around. And it still has its grip on me. And that's why after today's session, I'm taking a car full of collectors to Jack's Record Cellar in the Haight-Ashbury district to look at 78s. One other thing, it's kind of a favor. A lot of these images came from Darlene Brown, Don Brown's widow. And as I was leaving the house, she said, can you do something with these? Don published these in 1977. And if you can get something for it, fine. Otherwise, I just like collectors to have them. I'd like to get, if anybody wants to have one, they can have one. If somebody wants to pay a token $5, all that money will go to Darlene. This is called A Guide to Collector's Items that Don wrote. It's kind of a primer on record collecting. It explains sizes and speeds, conditions, masters, matrix numbers, and answers questions such as, how old is old? Where did the collector's items go? And now that I have found them, how do I sell them? And there's also kind of a humorous, at least by today's standards, a sample price list of what collector's items were worth back then. So see me afterwards. But I want to tell Darlene that everybody's got one and they're all gone now. Thank you very much.
Do you have questions?
Any questions?
Do we have questions for Perry? Hi.
Me?
Ma'am, yes.
What happened to Marilyn's first husband, the guy who started it all?
Yeah. Dave Stewart. Yeah, he died in 1984. When she divorced him and married Erdogan,
yeah.
That's my belief. I mean, this is still a work in progress, and I still have to figure out exactly what happened there. But she and Nesui had to divide it. Dave Stewart went to work for Lester Koenig for a while when he had Contemporary Records. And I believe Erdogan worked for him, too, while owning the Jazz Man at the same time.
Mm-hmm. When I first heard Creepy Fingerbuster, I was pretty surprised. And after a while I realized it sounded odd to me, and it turned out to be in the key of E, I think. And I slowed it down, I guess to E flat, I'd forgotten that. It was just 25 years ago. And it sounds more natural. And you can also hear quite a few errors.
Uh-huh.
So I hadn't applied that to the others in that group.
I don't know if it was pitch corrected when it was put to CD. I haven't heard that. If anybody knows, they can let me know. Anything else?
Any connection between between Jazz Man ever and Lee Blacklist?
Well, I would imagine that he came into the store just about every Los Angeles-based musician did. They all knew the place, and it's possible, but finding Charles Campbell would be a great guy to ask about that. So it's hard after all these years to find people who were actually there, and especially when a celebrity was there. Okay?
I'm giving everybody 5 more minutes for the silent auction.
Thank you, Carrie.